The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Health Letter and the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. The first article comes from the Harvard Health Letter of February 2021, and it's entitled, "Will These Surprising Factors Really Raise Your Blood Sugar? Learn What Will and Won't Increase Blood Sugar Levels and Put Your Health in Jeopardy." It's essential to keep your blood sugar from spiking or rising suddenly, whether you're healthy or you're among the 122 million Americans who have diabetes or prediabetes. But with all the conflicting advice in circulation, it can be hard to figure out what foods and habits you need to avoid. On the internet, you'll find many reports of factors that purportedly increase blood sugar. Here are a few claims that you should know about because they just don't hold up. The first is stress from sunburn pain. Stress hormone levels have the side effect of raising blood sugar, and sunburn does slightly raise levels of stress hormones. But when we think about what induces stress, the big ones are heart attack, overwhelming infection like COVID-19, or third-degree burns, not sunburn. You should avoid sunburn because it's bad for your skin, not because it's going to raise your stress levels and increase blood sugar, says Dr. David M. Nathan, director of the Diabetes Center and Clinical Research Center at Massachusetts General Hospital and professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. The next one is dehydration that increases the concentration of blood sugar. You'd have to be so dehydrated that you need to be hospitalized in order for dehydration to raise your blood sugar, Dr. Nathan explains. A third one is nasal steroid sprays. Corticosteroid pills can make your blood sugar rise, but there's no need to worry about corticosteroid nasal sprays for allergies like Flonase, which is also called fluticasone propionate. There's no effect on blood sugar, Dr. Nathan notes. The mucous membranes don't absorb enough steroids. Then there are speculative claims. The following claims about blood sugar spiking are speculative and are not proven. The first is caffeinated coffee. Caffeine does increase stress hormone levels a little, but any effect of caffeine on blood sugar is quite small. The real risk from coffee is putting too much sugar in it, which will raise the blood sugar, Dr. Nathan points out. The next one is artificial sweeteners. The internet contains claims that the consumption of artificial sweeteners is associated with increased blood sugar. If you drink sugary soda, it will spike your blood sugar like a rocket. In contrast, if you drink a sugarless soda with artificial sweeteners, it doesn't cause your blood sugar to spike, Dr. Nathan says. There is some inconclusive evidence that drinking a lot of soda with artificial sweeteners can slightly raise your baseline level of blood sugar, which is different from causing spikes in blood sugar. The next one is gum disease. Gingivitis, the early stage of gum disease, is a complication of diabetes. But whether the presence of gingivitis worsens diabetes is unknown. It could cause a stress reaction, but that would have only a minor effect on blood sugar, Dr. Nathan notes. Finally, the article points out claims that may hold up. Some internet claims about factors that raise blood sugar do have something to them. The first is skipping breakfast. People who skip breakfast and collapse all their calories into one or two meals are more likely to gain weight. And consuming large amounts of calories in one sitting is more likely to spike your blood sugar then spreading out your daily calories, Dr. Nathan says. Weight gain is the single greatest risk factor for developing diabetes. The next is losing sleep. Being sleep deprived for a few nights can affect blood sugar levels slightly, but Dr. Nathan says by itself, short-term sleep deprivation won't cause diabetes or make it worse. Chronically poor sleep quality is a diabetes risk factor. The next is the so-called dawn phenomenon. A variety of hormones increase during the night and keep the hormone insulin from shepherding blood sugar into cells, which increases blood sugar levels by the time you get up in the morning. This happens to all of us, but it's considered a problem only in people with type 1 or autoimmune diabetes. There are some well-established spikers. We know for sure that a number of factors raise blood sugar over time, increasing diabetes risk. It's these major triggers, like overeating, a sedentary lifestyle, and obesity, you should keep in mind, says Dr. Nathan, not factors with little or no risk. It's easier to switch to a caffeine-free coffee than manage your lifestyle, he says. But don't focus on minutiae. Focus on the main reasons that so many people are overweight or obese, overeating, and not enough activity that have resulted in overweight, obesity, and the diabetes pandemic. What's the prescription for long-term blood sugar control? Change your lifestyle. Eat smaller portions, decrease calories, reduce added sugars in your diet, increase your daily activity, and lose weight, Dr. Nathan advises. These are natural, pill-free approaches, and you should follow them. The next section of the Harvard Health Letter for February 2021 that I'm going to cover is called Ask the Doctor with Dr. Anthony Komaroff, MD, Editor-in-Chief. Should I get a COVID-19 antibody test? So the question is, should I get a test for COVID-19 antibodies even though I've never had any symptoms and I don't think I've had the virus? Answer. A blood test for COVID-19 antibodies tells you if you have been infected in the past. It does not accurately tell you if you are currently infected. You can get an antibody test through your doctor or possibly through a testing center set up in your state or city. To diagnose a person currently infected with COVID, a swab of the nose or saliva sample is tested by an antigen-detecting technique or by PCR. These tests are very accurate but not perfect. They can be false positive, suggesting infection where there wasn't any, or false negative, missing an infection you really have. So if a diagnostic test is false negative, it can be falsely reassuring, and if it's false positive, it can scare you unnecessarily. If you're curious as to whether you might have been infected without symptoms, you could get an antibody test. But as with any test, there are false positives and false negative. Worse, even an accurate positive antibody test does not guarantee that you are now immune to the virus. It can cause you to mistakenly believe you no longer need to protect yourself by physical distancing, mask wearing, and hand washing. That can be a bad, even fatal error. An antibody test can be useful in a person who has COVID-like symptoms, but a persistent negative nasal swab test, or in people who have persisting symptoms known as long COVID. In summary, while there are good reasons for some people to get a test for COVID-19 antibodies, I don't think it's necessary for most people. Should adult kids get a COVID-19 test before a visit home? So the question is, should I make my kids get tested for COVID-19 before they come visit me? As we go to press, in most communities in the United States and Europe, the virus still is widespread, particularly among young adults. Many young adults who become infected do not develop symptoms and therefore may not suspect that they are infected. Worse, they may be shedding the virus and able to infect others. Older people are more vulnerable to becoming severely ill from the virus than young adults, although some young adults and even children can become very ill. So if my kids had symptoms that might indicate they had COVID-19, I'd ask them not to come. If they had no symptoms but were living in a hot spot, I'd ask them to be tested before they traveled and not to visit if they tested positive. I'd hate not to see the kids, but it's a sacrifice we have to make until we control the virus. The next article is entitled, An Outlook Better Than Optimism, again from the Harvard Health Letter of February 2021. Optimism feels good. The expectation that positive things will happen is associated with happiness and better health, including fewer heart attacks and a lower risk of premature death. Pessimism, on the other hand, feels bad. It makes you depressed or anxious and keeps the fight-or-flight system activated, triggering chronic inflammation, which is linked to many diseases. You might think the best way to improve your well-being is to cultivate an optimistic outlook. Think again. Better than cultivating an artificial optimism is to see the situation and the world realistically, says Dr. Ronald Siegel, an assistant professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School and medical editor of the Harvard Special Health Report. Are you fooling yourself? Siegel says always assuming either an optimistic or pessimistic view of the situation is to ignore reality. If you're pessimistic, your mind defaults to the fantasy that something horrible could happen. You're filtering out the good data. If you're optimistic, you're filtering out the data that look bad for what you desire, and you are fooling yourself. Siegel says, instead of becoming attached to a fantasy of positive or negative outcomes, Siegel suggests that you focus on reality and your resilience in facing reality. Have the faith in yourself that you'll be able to rise to the occasion and deal with whatever comes your way, whether it's good or bad fortune, Siegel says. It's much more robust for well-being than deluding yourself into thinking things will always turn out well, because sometimes they don't. The following steps can help you gain the confidence to cope with uncertainty. The first is, take refuge in the present moment. Remember, the future doesn't exist yet. We only have thoughts about it. Bring attention to the present. The sun is shining, the trees have lost their leaves, you can walk. Bring your attention to what's here right now, says Siegel. That's not deluding yourself, that's reality. Forge safe social connections. Having a good support system of friends and family helps us to cope with life's ups and downs. Rather than deluding ourselves with optimism or pessimism, we can cultivate relationships so that when good things happen, we have people to celebrate with. And when bad things happen, we can comfort each other, Siegel says. How can you build relationships during a pandemic? Siegel advises joining online groups and connecting with people via video or phone calls. Identify with something larger than yourself. Broaden your connection to all of life, humanity, nature, the planet. When you identify with something much more enduring than a current situation, you get beyond the need to cling to one particular outcome, Siegel says. How do you connect to something larger? It can be through religion or simply history. Bad things have happened throughout history, yet life has endured, and it will continue to endure, Siegel reminds us. The final pathway to having faith to cope with uncertainty is finding meaning in life, something that matters to you. The source of meaning is different for everyone, and it changes throughout life. Think of it as what you gets you out of bed in the morning. It could be art that you create, religion, a relationship, acts of service, or projects you're working on. Whatever it is that matters, pursue it, Siegel says. Find ways to be engaged in meaningful activities. It takes time to break old habits, and it's okay if it's hard to make a change and give up optimistic or pessimistic thinking. But even a little shift in your approach will improve your well-being. We'll all do better, Siegel says, if we live as though reality were real instead of being shocked by it. And there's a small associated article. It's called Becoming More Mindful. Mindfulness brings your attention to the present moment. To try a mindfulness exercise, sit quietly, close your eyes, and focus on your breathing for a few minutes. Slowly begin to widen your focus. Become aware of sounds, sensations, and ideas. Allow each thought or sensation to pass without judging it as good or bad. If your mind starts to race, return your focus to your breathing. Then expand your awareness again. Try to sustain this awareness for longer periods each time you try the exercise. Free guided mindfulness exercises from Harvard psychologist Ronald Siegel are available online at https://drronsiegel.com. That's drronsiegel.com/recordedmeditations. That's RECORDMEDITATIONS. The next article is called Tai Chi or Yoga, Four Important Differences. Tai Chi and yoga have many similarities. Both are gentle, low-intensity exercises that have been practiced for hundreds of years. Both are good for your mind and body, and both have been shown to be beneficial for older adults in particular. But how do you choose one over the other? Several differences can influence your choice. Number one, flowing versus static movements. Tai Chi and yoga use different types of movements to challenge your muscles and balance. Tai Chi is like a graceful dance of flowing motions. As you perform a series of slow, choreographed movements, you breathe deeply, focus on your body sensations, and gradually shift your weight from one pose to another. Yoga is a series of focused, mostly static, strengthening and stretching postures combined with breathing techniques. Two is standing versus sitting. Both Tai Chi and yoga can be adapted for people who want or need to sit in a chair while exercising. But generally speaking, Tai Chi is performed while standing. Yoga can involve standing, lying down, sitting on the floor, and kneeling on all fours. Some positions require you to bend, reach backward, or even turn upside down. These are important considerations if you don't have access to a chair-based program and you either can't stand for long periods or have difficulty getting up and down off the floor. Three, a lot to remember. Tai Chi and yoga both have an instructor who leads you through the exercises. Some people have trouble following or memorizing Tai Chi choreography. The good news, though, is that many modern Tai Chi programs have been simplified to include only a small number of movements that can be done in an easy-to-learn, repetitive manner, says Peter Wayne, faculty editor of the Harvard Special Health Report, An Introduction to Tai Chi, and director of the Osher Center for Integrative Medicine at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. Number four is standout benefits. While Tai Chi and yoga have similar benefits, each has a particular effect that stands out in scientific studies. Tai Chi improves your balance, and that leads to a 20 to 60% reduction in falls. The exercise sharpens all the skills you need to stay upright: leg strength, flexibility, range of motion, reflexes, and awareness of body sensation and mental focus. Yoga is good at reducing pain, especially back, neck, and other musculoskeletal pain. This could be from gradually stretching and strengthening of muscles that support the back, like the paraspinal muscles that help you bend your spine, and the multifidus muscles that stabilize your vertebrae. Yoga also may reduce pain by reducing mental stress. Stress tends to increase the perception of pain. Choosing between yoga and Tai Chi often comes down to personal preference and practical considerations. Try them and see what you like, Wayne suggests. You might enjoy flowing movement more than being still. You can also let your abilities guide you. If you have memory challenges, you might want to try yoga first. If you have severe arthritis, Tai Chi might be an easier option than yoga. But both types of exercises can be adapted for your ability, even if you have Parkinson's disease or other physically limiting conditions. And that makes the instructor an important consideration. You want a teacher who will adapt protocols to ensure that they're safe and the appropriate level of challenge for you, Wayne says. If you have a health condition, it can help to have an instructor who also has medical training, like a nurse or a physical therapist. To find those experts, turn to sources you can trust, like hospitals or academic centers. Check out exercise videos, outdoor exercise classes, of course, standing at least 6 feet apart from others, or an online exercise class, such as the ones offered by Harvard Health Publishing. And the website for that is www.harvardhealthonline.com/catalog, CATALOG. The next article is entitled Extra Support for Better Health. Reaching a health or wellness goal is challenging for anyone, whether the objective is losing weight, lowering cholesterol, or improving endurance. Fortunately, you don't have to go it alone. Seek out these pros when you need guidance, support, or inspiration. The first is health and wellness coaches. Health coaches are part of a relatively new evidence-based field of medicine that requires coach training followed by certification from the National Board for Health and Wellness Coaching. What they do. Coaches enable you to shift your mindset and develop new healthy behaviors. Coaches help you define what your vision for optimal health looks like. Together, you figure out your motivation, why it matters, how to use your strengths to make sustainable changes, and where to start, says Margaret Moore, a pioneer of the field who co-founded and chairs the Institute of Coaching at Harvard-affiliated McLean Hospital, and is a faculty member of the Harvard Medical School Office of Global Education. How they work. Health and wellness coaches help you generate new awareness and insights so you can design a plan of action. Then you work with your coach on a combination of 3 to 5 behavioral changes. experimenting with new habits until you find a formula that works for you. Meeting for coaching sessions twice a month. There are general health and wellness coaches who can assist you with a broad range of goals, and specialized coaches who focus on maintaining a particular health challenge, like high blood pressure, diabetes, stress, or sleep problems. Coaches have varied backgrounds. Some are doctors or nurses. Some have exercise or nutrition backgrounds. Find one who's fairly close to your age and has the expertise that matches the particular challenge you want to confront. Another area would be nutrition experts. An example would be a dietitian. Dietitians are experts in diet and nutrition. They develop eating plans tailored to your needs so you can prevent or treat chronic disease. They can also advise you about what to eat in order to lose or gain weight. To practice, a dietitian must have a college degree and additional training, pass a national exam, and have a state license. There's also a person called a culinary or cooking coach. This new type of expert is a cross between a chef and a health coach. A coaching certification is not required, but culinary coaches must earn a certificate of completion from the only program offering the training, which is the Harvard-affiliated Institute of Lifestyle Medicine at Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. And what does a culinary coach do? Well, we use coaching principles and cooking expertise to teach people how to shop for and prepare healthy meals. The session topics are up to the patient. Some people want to learn about legumes, others how to cook fish. Each person determines the program and learns how to cook tailored meals in their own kitchen, which helps them adopt new behaviors. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. I sure hope you enjoyed it. Thank you.